Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and check in on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews, recaps, previews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week, I'm alongside my co-host, Fred Alvader. Fred, hi, how are you again?
Hey, good evening, Carlos. You would think we are in the middle of the golf season with five important golf tournaments to talk about from last week. And for a guy my age to be talking about a professional golf tournament that was held in Vietnam is absolutely surreal. PGA Tour rookie Harold Varner stumbled on the final day down under, but still collected a big check. Bubba won in the Bahamas, and a Chinese woman earned a return trip to the LPGA Tour by lapping the field at the LPGA Q School. And, Carlos, we don't want to fail to mention sign up, our listeners to sign up for our winter golf getaway to Gulf Shores, Alabama. It's a condo, a beachfront condo, 3 days, two nights, 54 holes of golf. Can't beat it. You know, warm sun, white sandy beaches. Hey, let's go, Carlos.
Let's go. Don't forget to sign up. Don't forget to sign up. It's never too late until we give it away. But anyway, let's start right away with the weekend backspin. And I'm going to start talking about the PGA Tour, where Bubba Watson fired a final round of 66 to win the Hero World Challenge by three shots from countryman Patrick Reed. He finished at 25 under par and earned $1 million. He was two shots clear going into the final day, and he moved further ahead with four birdies in the first seven holes. He was on fire. I remember the interview when they told him, are you going to just play safe or not? He said, no, you have to just go out and make birdies. Birdies, he did four in the first seven holes. He never looked threatened and could afford to make a bogey up to the home hole and still win some with something to spare. Patrick Reed also fired a 66 to claim second place and move into the top 10 in the official world golf rankings. Ricky Fowler, he scored an excellent 64 to end the week in third, one ahead of world number one Jordan Spieth, who was the halfway co-leader. Some takeaways from that tournament, Bubba Watson, he almost didn't play this event. He turned down an invitation originally as he didn't have a passport for his newly adopted daughter, Dakota. But when Jason Day, he pulled out, Watson's wife fast-tracked the application process, and the family was able to travel, and now they're $1 million richer. And this was Watson's ninth career victory, and the second year running, he has won multiple titles. Jordan Spieth, at the end of the tournament, he relaxed and went with Michael Greller, his caddy, and were able to reflect on the incredible year as they walked up to the 18th year, one in which Spieth has won two majors, the Tour Championship, and became world number one. Englishman Paul Casey and Justin Rose, they enjoyed mixed fortunes there in New Providence. Casey had a chance to put pressure on Watson after a birdie on 13th. Got him four under for the day, but the double bogey in the 16th paid to his chances. Rose, on the other chance, he didn't do much over the first 3 days, failing to rake 70 in any of those rounds, but he cut fire in the final round. He ripped around in the course of 62, a course record. And finally, Indians Annie Barlahiri and Hideki Matsuyama of Japan, they couldn't get anything going in the Bahamas. They finished tied for last place, 21 shots behind Bubba. But it was hardly a wasted week for them, Fred. They earned $102,500 for their efforts, which is not bad for playing poorly.
Yeah, big fairways there. I was curious to see that golf course because several of those guys have places there. It's owned by Tavistock. A lot of the guys that hang out there at Windermere go over there and stay. But big fairways just fit Bubba's game perfectly. He could just blast it out there and have wedges into all those greens. I loved his number one comment. If he ever gets to be number one, he's going to retire. I don't think you have to worry about that. Bubba's way too inconsistent to ever get to number one. Hey, there was a golf tournament down in Australia, the Australian PGA. Yet another talented 20-something, 24-year-old Nathan Holman collected his first professional victory on home soil as he overcame Dylan Fratelli and American Harold Varner to win in a playoff at the Australian PGA Championship. Holman began the day with a two-stroke lead, but a double bogey at the first hole erased that. He bounced back to finish tied with Varner and Fratelli, but when both of them missed the green in the first playoff hole, he secured a victory and full membership on the European Tour. In addition, the win gave him the 2015 Australian PGA Order of Merit and earned him a spot in the 2016 Open Championship at Royal Troon in July. 25-year-old Varner just earned his PGA Tour card via the Web.com Tour, is ranked number 278 in the world. He played in five of the wraparound season events this fall, made four cuts, and earned $276,000. His best finish in the U.S. was a T5 at Mayakoba, where he earned $235,000. He will pocket €106,000, about $115,000 U.S., for his runner-up finish down under. $350,000 for 3 months' work for the young Varner. That's not too bad. Oh, did I happen to mention, Carlos, that Varner is originally from Ohio, just in case you didn't know? Sweden's David Lingmerth, who won the Memorial Tournament, oh, that's also held in Ohio last June, was among the leaders heading to the last day, but a final round 76 left him tied for ninth.
Hey, talking about Australia, an Australian, Mark Leishman, he outplayed Henrik Stenson of Sweden in sweltering conditions in Sun City, and he won the Nedbank Golf Challenge by six strokes. Leishman, he began the day, the final day, one stroke ahead of Henrik Stenson, and the Swede was never able to get on level terms. Both men dropped a shot at the third, but birdies for Leishman at the seventh and eighth holes took him to a turn too clear of Stenson. Stenson finished a distant second, while Chris Wood of England snatched third place thanks to a solid final round of 68 and a couple of blunders by other players. Robert Streb looked to have solo third swung up, but he doubled to the last to drop back into a tie for fourth with Brendan Grace, who three-putted the final green. Victor Dubuisson and the defending champion Danny Willett there tied with him. Some takeaways from this tournament that we have to talk about Mark Leishman. It's been quite a year for him. In April, as you might remember, his wife almost lost her life after seriously falling ill with toxic shock syndrome. It saw her put into an induced coma. At that stage, golf was a long way down the Australian's agenda. But thankfully, others came through the scare, and Mark slowly has gotten back into the game. In July, he proved his potential by making a playoff for the Open Championship. This one is a significant win for him because it secures his place well inside the top 40 in the official World Golf Rankings, gaining him an entry into the significant tournaments next year. He also walk away with a check of $1.2 million. That's a reasonable Christmas bonus. For Henrik Stenson, man, he couldn't find a spark on the final day. He strolled towards the end of the third round, and those travails continue on Sunday. His score of 72 could have been a good deal worse had he not saved himself on a number of occasions from awkward spots. It was his sixth runner-up this year. Incredible bridesmaid there. Henrik Stenson couldn't muster a win this year. And the defending champion, Danny Willett, he performed admirably to finish the week in a tie for fourth. During the second round, he was struggling to such an extent with back trouble that it looked as though he may not be able to finish the tournament. He limped away with a 75, but bounced back brilliantly. Fred on the weekend with rounds of 70 and 68. So, great story, Mark Leishman, after his struggles there in April with his wife, back in full swing and well into the top 50 in the official World Golf Rankings.
Yeah, and amazing to see Andy Sullivan and Emiliano Grillo both had a great year, both on the European Tour and then Grillo also here in America. So really, really good years for those guys. You know, the Nedbank started out as the old Sun City Challenge, which was the first event to offer $1 million first-place check to its winner back in 1987. And, of course, Johnny Miller won $500,000 in the very first Sun City $1 million Challenge in 1981. And now, next year, it's going to become part of the Race to Dubai Final Series. That's going to bring a lot of attention to South African golf, Carlos. Hey, LPGA Q School was held last week. Dreams were on the line, but only the top 20 out of the 156 woman field earned full status on the 2016 LPGA Tour. The biggest news coming out last week was the domination of the field by Simon Fang from China. She claimed medalist honors by 7 shots over her nearest competitor and tied for the third lowest score since the LPGA went to 5 rounds for its final qualifying tournament in 2004. Fang played on the LPGA Tour in 2015 but lost her card and had to regain it via Q School. She came into last week making the cut in 4 of her last 5 events of the year. She said, "I'm very excited. Last year I had a really bad final day to finish 6th in Q School, but this year I got it done with a win. I'm looking for better things to happen for me." Fang has lived in Florida for 10 years and said this is where she is most comfortable. "I won junior golf tournaments and I won in college, so winning here is my first professional event win since turning pro. It can definitely help me get some momentum going into next year." 3 players were forced to go overtime to fight for that last 2 tour cards in a 3-hole aggregate playoff. Jin Yang and Benyapa Nifasofan, both escaped with cards securely in hand, while Christine Song was forced to accept conditional status for next year. Friend of the Back Nine Report, Holly Clybourne from England, finished T15 and then jetted off to Dubai to compete in the final event on the Ladies European Tour this season. Carlos, you're going to tell us about Vietnam.
Oh, yes, I will. But first, I have to say congratulations on that pronunciation of the names. You did excellent. I mean, incredible improving those pronunciations.
That is incredible.
Yeah. Hey, talk about Vietnam. It was a long way for Sergio Garcia to go to finally win his first title in 2 years this weekend. He ended a 2-year wait for a title by coming through a 4-man playoff to win the whole time open on Sunday. The Spaniard, he defeated Himat Rai on the second playoff hole of the Asian Tour's inaugural tournament in Vietnam. Himat Rai.
He's a golfer?
Yes, and he played very well. That approach shot on the 18th, wow. Well, Lee Wen-Tang and Warren Ratchat, they failed to make it past the first hole in that playoff, allowing Garcia to triumph on the Greg Norman design course. Garcia made a double bogey on 17th after finishing the first 9 holes in just 29. As a result of Garcia's drop shots, the Asian of 3 of Rai, Wen-Tang, and Wirechat, they were able to force extra holes after carding final rounds of 67, 67, 70, respectively. So without a win since the Qatar Masters in 2014, Garcia finished 31st in the Race to Dubai rankings this year. He finished 2nd twice on the PGA Tour last season, with his base major result of the last 12 months coming at the Open in July when he finished T6. So great to seeing him master that 30-foot birdie on the first playoff hole and par on the second to ensure the 35-year-old for the title. But, wow, had to go all the way to Vietnam to win one.
That's a long ways to go. And they had him wearing funny hats and, you know, doing poses for all kinds of publicity pictures. I'm sure they had a lot of fun.
Well, that wraps up the weekend backspin. When we come back, we're going to take our first short break. And when we come back, we're going to have our Par 5 news presented by United Golf Network. So don't go away.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the Par 5 news presented by United Golf Network. Fred, as usual, you have the tee shot, and you're going to talk to us about some reports that have been surfacing about Tiger Woods. So what's going on?
Yeah, we got Tiger in the news. While Tiger hosted his Hero World Golf Challenge last week in the Bahamas, his sit-down interview with Time Magazine's Lauren Rubenstein was all over the golf news. Ron Green Jr. was also in the Bahamas and wrote a great piece in Global Golf Post about Woods' more relaxed world right now. Rubenstein's piece described a calmer, more introspective Tiger Woods, a champion turning 40 years old at the end of this month, who has undergone three back surgeries in the last 18 months and just wants to be able to play ball with his kids and be able to do something besides walk and play video games. Tiger said he does not watch golf on TV unless one of his good friends is in contention. He can't stand watching when he can't be a part of it. He is only allowed to walk for a few minutes at a time and immediately returns to the couch or a bed. He does not have a plan except to do exactly nothing until the doctors tell him he can do otherwise. No rehab, no practice, and no timetable. He is obviously frustrated. He has talked with other athletes that have gone through this type of surgery and rehab, like Peyton Manning. The toughest thing for an athlete is doing nothing and not knowing when or if they will be able to return to the capabilities that they once possessed. Woods played the elder statesman role to perfection at his Hero World Challenge last week, trolling the fairways in a golf cart and spending time in the broadcasting booth, mugging with Terry Gannon and Roger Maltby. One comment from the Rubenstein piece that I found interesting, Woods loves the way Jordan Spieth maneuvers his way around the course, playing to his strengths, and compared him to a more athletic Jim Furyk. Woods is out of action for some time to come. A takeaway from the Tiger we saw last week in the Bahamas and read about in the interview was a more mature and uncertain golfer knowing that the end of one of the most illustrious careers in golf has ever seen is rapidly coming to an end, Carlos.
And it's a very, very sad story to see him that way. And oh, my God. Well, hopefully he can at least come back and play some golf, maybe not competitively as he used to, but at least he can come back and play and have a normal life. Hey, let's talk a little bit about some golf courses news. Let's start talking first. 2019 was already going to be fun with the Pebble Beach U.S. Open, and now the USGA has announced a pair of exciting venues for the U.S. Women's Open and U.S. Mid-Amateur, while also making a great statement with its secondary mid-venue. First comes the Country Club of Charleston in Charleston, South Carolina, who will host the 2019 U.S. Open Women's Championship, will be conducted May 30 to June 2. The Country Club of Charleston has a storied tradition of hosting state and regional tournaments, and I will add a women's major to that tradition. This will be the second USGA championship conducted there. The club previously hosted the 2013 U.S. Women's Amateur Championship, which was won by Emma Talley 2-1 over U.S. Cindy Fang. Then comes the Colorado Golf Club in Parker, Colorado, as the host site for the 2019 U.S. Mid-Amateur Championship, which is an event first played in 1981 and open to amateurs aged 25 and older with a handicap index not exceeding 3.4. This will be the first USGA championship contested there. The dates for that championship will be September 21 to the 26th. The course there was designed by Bill Coore and two-time major Masters champion Ben Crenshaw. It opened for play in 2007 and hosted a U.S. Open local qualifier in 2008, as well as sectional qualifiers for the U.S. Amateur and U.S. Women's Amateur in 2007. Another piece of news regarding golf courses, hey, sources tell golf.com that Tom Weisskopf and his design firm, Tom Weisskopf Designs, along with Wadsworth Construction, have been selected on a design-build contract with the City of San Diego Parks and Recreation to renovate the Torrey Pines North Course in La Jolla, one of the country's busiest and most scenic municipal courses, and co-host of the PGA Tour's Farmers Insurance Open. Until recently, the leading candidate for that job was none other than Phil Mickelson, San Diego native and three-time winner of the Farmers. For 3 years, Mickelson's design firm planned all the preliminary work, but a pending ruling by the California Fair Political Practices Commission prevented his firm from proceeding with the work. So tough luck for Lefty there. This renovation budget is about roughly $12.6 million, and the work will take about 6 months, starting from the completion of the Farmers in late January. And finally, about 70 17 protesters, not 17, 17 members of the Friends of the Black River Forest Group were out in front of the American Club and other Herb Kohler properties on Saturday on the town of Wilson, shouting various chants, including "Build families, not fairways," and "Hands off our water, Kohler." They got a few claps and cheers from solidarity from nearby Kohler union members who are about to enter their fourth week of striking against the company over wages and benefits. So, hey, Herb Kohler is having a very bad time there. They have fervently opposed his plan for an economic boon to that town who has struggled with to bring business and tax revenue. They argue that the deforestation of the land will be vast, rare species will be destroyed, and the entire project will degrade the natural resources of the area, one of the few undeveloped pieces of property on the Wisconsin shore of Lake Michigan. The town of Wilson is currently, Fred, engaged in a lawsuit before the state court of appeals over failed business park development and whether the land can be annexed by the city of Sheboygan. So tough times there for that golf course in Herb Kohler.
Yeah, it's too bad. Kohler has a history of really building good stuff along with Pete Dye, you know, Whistling Straits and the other property there, Black River, whatever the other place is called. They're just beautiful properties. And been there a couple times, and I hope he gets this done because kind of looking forward to it. Hey, Carlos, love is in the air on both the PGA and the LPGA tours. The jewelry stores are hopping this time of year as it is the engagement season, and it is no different for high-profile golfers. With more time on their hands in the off-season, evidently their thoughts turn to more mundane things in life like engagements and romance and such. Can you imagine that? Well, this is a season for getting engaged, and, of course, the TV ads are full of the diamond commercials to make her feel special and make her say yes. Well, Rory McIlroy took the plunge again and asked PGA Tour employee Erica Stoll to become his betrothed. In Paris, no less, the boy is such a romantic. If you remember, Rory has gone down this road once before with his highly public engagement to women's tennis star Caroline Wozniacki, but called it off when they actually started planning a huge New York wedding. That would be scary. Stoll and Rory have been a thing for nearly a year, but no dates have been reported for the wedding day. Whenever they decide to tie the knot, I don't think the newlyweds will be in a bind for cash. The Irish Examiner recently reported Rory's net worth just slightly north of the $440 million mark. Nothing says I love you forever, dear, like, here, please sign this prenup. Beth Ann Nichols reported in Golf Week that another high-profile professional golfer, the number three-ranked female golfer in the world, Stacey Lewis, who, by the way, was born here in Toledo, Ohio, announced her engagement to University of Houston women's golf coach Jared Chadwell. She said yes while attending a football game on the grounds of her beloved University of Arkansas. What says pure romance better than, woo, pig suey? Lewis, 30 years old, met Chadwell around the Christmas holidays last year when her former golf coach at Arkansas, Kelly Hester, now at Furman, got the idea to connect the two lovebirds at the 2014 Women's Golf Coaches Association convention in Las Vegas. Where Lewis had been inducted into the WGC Hall of Fame and sat on a Q&A panel in front of coaches from both men's and women's programs. Isn't love a beautiful thing, Carlos?
He was very smart not to do it, you know, in front of the big jumbotron or something like that. In the game. I think he would have gotten a no right there.
Well, she's pretty quiet and subdued, you know. I don't think she'd see the humor in that, no.
No. He knew better. He knew better. So let's talk a little bit about Australia and some news there in golf. Golf Australia, he's the chief executive, Stuart Pitt. He says he will not pressure former world number one Adam Scott to help spearhead Australia's Olympic Games squad after ambitiously targeting more than two representatives in the men's field for Rio. On the same day that he announced the Australian Open will revert back to Royal Sydney next year, P Pete said he would give Scott as much time as he wanted to decide on his real availability. Scott has been lukewarm in his attitude towards the landmark Olympic Games, especially considering the men's field will be forced to skip the opening ceremony before rushing to the USPGA to Brazil. He shouldn't be there. I mean, if you don't want to go, just let him be there. Let him be at home. Australia's number one ranked player, Jason Day, has indicated his preference to be at Rio, he knows better, as one of the two players in line to qualify for the select field of 60. The top 15 players in the world at the July cutoff will be granted entry, with up to four from any nation within that bracket eligible for Rio. Outside of the top 15, any country will be restricted to two representatives for the tournament, which will end golf's 112-year absence from the sport's grandest stage. Day is number two right now in the world. Scott is number 12. They would be Australia's hopes if the tournament was held today. Mark Leishman, who's number 44, and Stephen Bowditch, number 71, would be the others. On the ladies' side, Minji Lee and Kerry Webb shape as Australia's duo in the women's field so far, and that seems like a very good one. And like I mentioned before, on the final day of the Australian Open at the Australian Golf Club, Pitt announced next year's event will shift across town to Royal Sydney, the scene of the famous final round shootout between Rory McIlroy and Adam Scott back in 2013. Golf Australia only last month signed an 8-year final agreement for the Australian Open to be played with the state government, but a clause exists which allows organizers to take it interstate twice in that time frame. Pitt said 2017 might be a stretch for it to leave the Harbour City, but Victorian and Queensland courses will now be desperate to lure the Stonehaven Cup away from Sydney after that. So we'll see what happens. And finally there, Jason Day, he has vowed to return to Australia next year, making it likely that he and Adam Scott will defend their World Cup crown and potentially headline the domestic summer. Day made the promise during his acceptance speech of the inaugural Greg Norman Medal, where he also expressed his drive for even more success next year. 28-year-old was unable to come home this summer to celebrate his achievements on the USPGA Tour with his Australian fans, having decided to be with his wife for the birth of their daughter Lucy just 3 weeks ago. However, Day is determined, Fred, that his homecoming will happen late next year, providing a tantalizing prospect for promoters, especially those of the World Cup, which will be played in Melbourne in mid to late November, and where he and Adam Scott will be defending the team title.
Yeah, they're a pretty good 1-2 punch, aren't they? That's pretty strong. Have you seen Scott putting with the shorter putter?
Yep.
He was doing it there in the Bahamas. He doesn't look real comfortable with it, but he hits his iron shots so well. He only has to be a 50-50 putter. He should still score pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
The Tribune News in San Luis Obispo, California, reported that retired Raytheon Company chairman William Bill Swanson and his wife Cheryl made the largest single donation in the history of Cal Poly Sports, $10.2 million to the university's golf program. It's one of the largest cash donations ever made to a collegiate golf program. Swanson played on the golf team while earning his degree in engineering before embarking on a 40-year career at Raytheon. He served as chairman and CEO of the defense contractor from January 2004 to 2014. He stepped down as CEO in March of 2014 and retired from the company later that year. You know, before researching this piece, Carlos, I couldn't even tell you where Cal Poly was located. The school enrollment totals approximately 21,000 students, which, you know, that's a nice-sized school. It's located smack dab between San Francisco and L.A. and is known for engineering, business, and its architecture schools. It competes in the Big West Conference as well as the Big Sky in football, but when you hear the name Cal Poly, you don't immediately conjure up visions of national championship, Heisman Trophy winners, and cheerleaders. The school does have an impressive list of former athletes that have gone on to fame and fortune, however. Ozzie Smith, the Hall of Fame baseball player. John Madden, we all know who John is. Chuck the Iceman Liddell, who's an ultimate fighting champ. I don't know who that is, but evidently somebody does. Lauren Roberts, the boss of the Moss, went to Cal Poly. Well, anyhow, this generous donation will provide scholarships and establish an endowment named the Swanson Cal Poly Golf Program. The endowment will focus on engineering and first-generation student athletes and will allow participation in national tournaments, a bigger budget for travel, and recruiting and improved gear for men's and women's teams. They can travel first class now, man. You take pick up limos at the airport. You know, we're not traveling no buses. Hey, the coach is pretty excited. The players are pretty excited. You know, this is a huge windfall for a school known more for its high SAT scores than its football team's win-loss record. But $10 million for a college golf team, that seems a little over the top to me, Carlos. You know, I'm all for growing golf and providing funds for the growth, but $10 million, I would think the engineering department would have liked to see some of that cash. You know, I'm just guessing here. So
just
anyhow,
a wild guess, right? Just a wild guess.
Just a wild guess.
Wow.
Well, anyhow, you know, we see football powers building the state-of-the-art training centers and field houses to attract the best young players at their schools. Well, evidently this idea is carrying over to golf. So the competition for attracting the best high school golfers to your alma mater is getting pretty heated. So you better go line up those $10 million donors to improve your golf facilities. Hey, Carlos, this wraps up the Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network. United Golf Network has been sending me out a daily special with Christmas ideas. Some of them, you know, Nike and Greg Norman apparel, the half-zip windbreakers, flat-front Adidas shorts. That's a real deal. They're 30% under retail right now. Addy Power Sports Boost shoes. I just bought a pair of these Addy Power Boost shoes. I love them. They're really nice. Adidas Climacool vest. That's not even in stores yet, and you can buy it online through United Golf Network. Adicross Grip More golf shoes. You know, you get the comfort and you get the style. Really nice golf shoes. All this is available by visiting UnitedGolfNetwork.com. I'm going to be posting things to Facebook. People can watch for that. They can click on and pick up some of these specials. If you have a golfer you're going to be buying for Christmas, you may want to look at that. And I also should mention right here, Carlos, that NWO Golf Links will be published the December issue tomorrow morning. And in it, we not only have one list, we have two Christmas lists for readers to check to offer great gifts for your favorite golfer. So log on to United Golf Network, check out NWO Golf Links tomorrow, all kinds of good stuff, all kinds of good ideas for Christmas gifts, Carlos.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we have our VIG, very important guest of the week. His name is Tony Heer, so don't go away.
Thank you for listening to the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our VIG, very important guest of the week. His name is Tony Heer. He's a golf sports travel writer, formerly a senior editor on Today's Golfer, Europe's biggest selling golf publication, and a staff writer for Four magazine before that. He has freelanced for almost 40 publications in the print and web around the world, focusing on golf and travel, and have been an editor of a small regional golf magazine. Recently, he won 5 awards at the International Network of Golf's Annual Media Awards, career a total of 12 so far, and have been twice awarded honorable mentions by the Golf Writers Association of America. He's also the author of 5 books, The History of Golf in 50 Holes, recently published in the UK, is soon to be published in the US. Fred had the chance to sit down with him for an interview. So what can we expect in this interview, Fred?
Yeah, Carlos, the book is now available in the U.S. It's available on Amazon and in bookstores. Really, really nice book. got the chance to meet Tony this summer on one of the golf trips that I was on, and I found him to be a really intelligent fellow. He's from the UK, he's had a great history. He's traveled around the world looking at golf courses and being involved in golf. Was a golf teaching professional in the UK until some health issues forced him to leave the golf course behind. He still plays a little bit, but has to kind of watch what he does. So really had a great time talking to him in this interview, and he has a couple of really great stories about his process in writing this book.
Okay, let's play it.
We are so happy to have Tony Deere on Back Nine Report tonight. We had the good fortune of meeting on a golf trip this summer, and he, being from the UK and a Scotch aficionado of some renown, helped duly inform an ignorant American on the correct pronunciation of a particular brand of single malt as we partook of some of that Scotland's finest export. Tony, how are you doing tonight?
I'm very well. How are you, Fred?
Fantastic. Tony, one of the things we like to ask people when we talk to them, how did you get started playing golf?
Probably the same way as 90% of the listeners. My father and my grandfather played, and every time my grandfather would come and visit, he would take us up to a little pitch and putt course just up the road from where we lived. I loved it. And when he was at home and I was with my dad, I caddied for my dad a lot. My dad was a member of a golf club, but also in Britain they have things called golf societies, which are the same thing as golf clubs in the States that don't have a premises, they don't have a clubhouse, they're just a group of golfers that get together five or six times a year. And because of that, they travel around to some of the best courses. I mean, we went to Walton Heath a number of times, Sunningdale, Wentworth, and I caddied for my dad. I was probably 13, 14 at the time, and I caddied for my dad at those. So I got to see a lot of England's great courses, and that's really how my interest blossomed.
So you progressed as a junior. I believe you even spent some time as a teaching professional.
Yes, I was. I started playing properly at about 15, I think, and then I was down to one scratch, probably by 18, 19. So I actually I became an apprentice pro at a club just south of London, with a view to becoming a club professional. Obviously, I was more of a teacher than a player. So I love teaching the game. I still do. And I think, yeah, I was an okay player, but I certainly wasn't good enough to ever make a living from playing the game. But I love teaching, and then sadly, I got some health problems, some pretty severe arthritis. So I had the 85-hour weeks, in the pro shop were a bit much. So I had to leave that and take up writing about the game instead.
Tony Deere, an internationally published golf and travel writer. He was a senior editor on Today's Golfer, Europe's biggest selling golf publication, and a staff writer for Four magazine. In addition, he has provided articles for nearly 40 publications around the world, focusing on golf and travel. He has won 12 International Network of Golf's Media Awards and has twice been awarded honorable mention by the Golf Writers Association of America. He has written 5 books, including the 101 Golden Rules of Golf, and his most recent effort is now available on Amazon and in bookstores, The History of Golf in 50 Holes. And, Tony, we want to talk a little bit about the story of golf in 50 holes. Can you tell us, give us a little bit of information about the new book, how you conceived the idea, and how did you ever get it down to a manageable number of only 50 holes?
Great question, Fred. I will start by saying it wasn't my idea. It was the publishing company's idea, first and foremost. The publishing company is called Quid. They're based in a town called Brighton, an hour south of London, very near where I used to live. They approached me, actually, my fourth book was with them, The 101 Golden Rules of Golf, which in the States is published as The Golfer's Handbook. And they were just a great company to work with. I really enjoyed it. Their editors were great. And they came to me with the idea of this, the history of golf book, in about much earlier in the year, 2014. And of course, I said, you know, there are 1,000 history of golf books out there. We have to do something different. So we eventually got it down. I said the golf holes, doing it, you know, specifying certain holes would be an interesting way to do it. And then we discussed it and got down to 50. Of course, there's 100, 200, 300 holes that, you know, where interesting things happen, but that's too much for most readers. So we got it down to 50. And then they took the idea to the Munich book fair, I believe in December 2014, and it generated quite a bit of interest. So they actually commissioned it in the summer of 2013 is when they took it to the Munich book fair, and they commissioned it in the summer of 2014. And I had about 4 or 5 weeks to write it, and it was, I think it's over 100,000 words, so it was pretty heavy workload. I think I was doing between 1,500 and 2,000 words every day for about 4 or 5 weeks. But as you know, when you're dealing with something you love so much, it's not work. It was fun.
You talk about some great holes, and I got a chance to look through the book, and it is really a great read, and urge all of our listeners to would make a great Christmas present for any golfaholic that's listening. What is your favorite chapter? What is your favorite hole or favorite story in the book?
Oh, Dan, how much time do you have for that? There's so many. My favorite in the book. I really enjoyed the chapters where, you know, obviously with a lot of, I think all of them actually, you know, as a golf writer, you have some sort of superficial knowledge of all of them. But there were a few where I was really lacking in knowledge, and so to research those really heavily was great fun. There's one in particular, the third hole at Biarritz. You know, the core golfers will know of the Biarritz holes, where there's a big dip in the green or just short of the green. And they were designed by C.B. McDowell, who was, you know, the first great architect in American golf history. And he had been to Europe to research holes that he would like to build, and, you know, things that he was looking for, things in Britain and Europe that he would like to incorporate in his own courses in the States, especially national golf links on Long Island. And he went to Biarritz, and there was a hole there called the Chasm Hole, which, let me try and paint the picture here. It was basically between one promontory and another, you know, with a chasm in between, a deep 100-foot chasm in between the tee and the green. But, you know, every link I could find, a lot of old magazines from the early 1900s, it became pretty clear that this hole in the form that it was built had actually disappeared by the time C.B. McDowell arrived at the course with his intentions of finding things to incorporate in his own course. I remember one night in shortly after being commissioned, I knew I was going to write about this hole at Biarritz. So I knew that I'd need to beef up my knowledge of the hole. So I was actually at a speaking engagement in Spokane, Washington one evening. And I got back to my hotel room at about 8 o'clock. I looked for a live game, football or I think it was a shoulder season, so there was a bit of baseball left. I think it was October, so the World Series was on. I think it was a break night, a rest night, so I couldn't find a live game on TV. So I thought, okay, tonight I'll do the research on the Biarritz. And so I opened my computer at about 8:10, and I turned it off at 5 o'clock the next morning, having followed every single link I could find on Biarritz holes. And it was fascinating, you know, when like I said earlier, you know, once you find a subject, you're just absorbed by it, totally engrossed by it. You just can't put it down. And I read everything, and you know, in the space of a few hours, my knowledge of Beerett's holes went from superficial to I suppose expert. And it was just fascinating. Other holes like that, which I obviously knew about, but not to the extent that I would like to have, was the 15th at North Berwick, the Redan, and the 13th at Pine Valley. Obviously, I knew I knew something of the story of the opening of Pine Valley, but to really research it in depth was fascinating. To read the story of George Crump and how the course came about and how it evolved and how it took so many years to build and eventually open, tragically after George Crump had died, was just fascinating. So that I think the third at Beerett's, the 15th at North Berwick, and the 13th at Pine Valley were my favourite chapters to research and to write. But on top of that, anything to do with Sergio Ballesteros is great, because he's the greatest of all time. He's my favorite.
Well, just looking through it, one of the chapters that I noticed, you talk about Mike Kaiser, who is foremost in golf course construction and using Corey Crenshaw and the Clay Kid and Tom Doak in his designs across the world right now. And you talk about him starting the Van and Dunes project, and everyone calling him nuts. And then you go on to talk about Kaiser bringing Mike Davis out to look at number 16 on his first course, the McClay Kid course. And Kid was anxiously awaiting Kaiser and Davis's verdict. I thought that was kind of unique, kind of a fun read.
It's such a wonderful story. It's stories like this that, you know, when you read so much about golf, you know, you're absorbed by it every day. It surrounds your life. It's these little stories, you know, these little insights that really make it so much more enjoyable. I was very fortunate to, I know David quite well, and he took me down to his course in Nicaragua, Guacalito de la Isla, a couple of years ago, and it was fabulous. And we were playing, actually, and he told me the story of how the 16th of Van and Dunes came about. You know, he was, if you can imagine, you know, he was a very green, inexperienced, young Scottish designer, and he'd been, it was funny how he describes Mike Kaiser. He said some rich dude from Chicago had hired me to build some course out in the middle, not in the middle of nowhere, obviously, because it's on the coast, but, you know, somewhere out in the boonies where no one knows and no one goes to play golf. So he knew how unconventional the project was, but at the same time, he also knew that the potential of it, because it was obviously Van and Dunes, the site is amazing. But when he arrived, he first went there with his father in the mid 90s, 94, I believe. The site was completely covered in gorse. He couldn't see a thing really under the gorse. So it took him a couple of years to clear it all, I suppose, as a solo designer. And then to get this opportunity to come to Bandon, he was still obviously unknown, pretty much, apart from in Kathmandu, but they probably didn't know him very well in Kathmandu either. So he had this wonderful opportunity, but all the time he was concerned that this rich dude from Chicago might fire him at any minute. And the 16th was, I'm sure readers have played Van and Dunes. They know the cliff top there at 16. It's an absolutely amazing site for a golf hole, but he had no idea how to what to do with it. And he and Kaiser spoke about it, and they didn't really come to any great decisions. But so one day when Kaiser was back in Chicago, where he lives and works, David went out and just dreamt up this the hole that it is now, you know, with the diagonal ridge, sandy ridge running short and left of the green to up towards the front right of the green. And it was a short par four, risk reward. And he loved it, but, you know, as with all holes like that, as with all holes with great character and, you know, something interesting about it, you either hate it or love it. And he had no idea how Mike Kaiser was going to react to this. it could jive with him. It might not. There's just something about it that he might dislike. But he knew, obviously, by now he'd known Mike for a long time, or, you know, for a couple of years. So he knew what sort of golf he liked. He knew that, you know, risk-reward strategy, links golf, you know, that's the sort of thing he liked. So he was fairly confident that Mike would, Mr. Kaiser would like this hole. When Mr. Kaiser came back from Chicago, he brought with him Mike Davis, who was a good friend of his. At the time, Mr. Davis was, he was setting up the U.S. Open Tour. I think he was director of rules and competition with the USGA. Of course, he's the executive director now, but at the time, he was the director of rules and competition. But he knew Mike Kaiser very well, so they came out, and Mike knew that Bannon Dunes was never going to be a U.S. Open course because it was, one, it was too short, and two, it was too remote. But he valued Mike Davis's opinion, and they went out to the hole, and if you can imagine, David Kidd was stood on the tee, and he could see at the other end of the hole on the green Mike Davis and Mike Kaiser discussing it and just looking it over. And this was brilliant. You know, David told me that he was hoping, he was kind of expecting, you know, them to walk together and to exchange high fives in the middle of the fairway, you know, and for Davis and Kaiser to both say what a fantastic hole it was. So he was watching them and hoping all the time that that's what was going to happen, but Kaiser and Davis just walked away. And there was no meeting in the middle of the fairway. And so Kidd was left, you know, squirming in his own feelings, you know, thinking, having no idea what they thought of the hole. He assumed it was bad, you know, they just walked away without saying anything. So he assumed his job was finished, he was going to get fired, and the hole would never come to be. And Mike Kaiser knew this, of course. He knew that, you know, David is a very strong character. You know, he's full of opinion. It's just amazing to spend time with. It's just so much fun. But he's stubborn, and he has very strong opinions. And I think Mr. Kaiser felt very strongly that, you know, there's times when David needs to be taken down a peg or two, and he needs to remember who's paying for this, and he needs to remember who's the boss. And so he knew very well what was going through David's mind, and he played it perfectly. And it was later that day in the evening that, you know, when they eventually got to meet up, and he said, "Yeah, David, that's a fantastic hole. It's brilliant. I love it." And that's how, you know, that's the story of the 16th. And it's stories like that which are just so much fun to find out and hear about and read and research.
The story of golf in 50 holes explores the 600-year history of the game of honor. It reveals the excitement and the challenges overcome, as well as the sweet victories, the sportsmanship, and the stars bursting onto the scene. The book talks about the course itself, describing the development, and, as you've heard Tony describe, how the hole came to be and how it's come to be, its claim to fame over the years. So 50 chapters, it's a good read. We want to thank Tony Deer for being our guest this evening on Backline Report. Urge listeners to find The Story of Golf in 50 Holes on Amazon or wherever good books are sold. Make a great read, a perfect Christmas present for your favorite golfaholic. Tony, once again, thanks, and we wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you and your family.
And to you, Fred. Thank you very much for having me on.
There you have it. That was Tony Deer, our VIG, very important guest of the week. Fred, anything you would like to add before we go on to the practice range?
No, you could hear there in the story about David McClay Kidd. He's spent some time with him. They've actually traveled around different countries to some of McClay Kidd's courses, so they have spent quite a bit of time together. And Tony's quite an interesting character himself. And just, you know, pick up the book, give it a read. I think you will enjoy it.
Okay, that wraps up our very important guest of the week. Very important guest, VIG. We're going to take one more short break. When we come back, we're going to have our practice range.
for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the practice range. But before we go to it, I just want to remind everybody that you have to do it. I mean, at the Back Nine Report, we're very excited because we're announcing our fantastic winter golf getaway for this month. Back Nine Report has partnered with Let's Golf Traveler to offer one of our lucky listeners a winter golf getaway to Gulf Shores, Alabama. This trip is for your favorite foursome, you and three more guests, and includes 3 days and two nights in a beachfront condo provided by Kaiser Realty and Wyndham Resort. Plus, we have thrown in 3 18-hole rounds of golf at Kraft Farms and Peninsula Golf and Racquet Club. White sandy beaches, 54 holes of golf, and warm, sunny Gulf Shores, Alabama. Fred, what could be better? Simply visit www.letsgolf.com/newsletter_sign-up. So don't miss it. Go there. Well, now it's time for the practice range, and every week Fred and I pick a topic and each one of us give our own take about it. But this week we're going to have a special take. We're going to have two subjects and two topics, and I'm going to discuss one. Fred, we'll talk about it a little bit, and then he'll have one, and then I might say a couple of words on it. So I'm going to start with our first theme, which is the youth movement in the world golf stage amid the fading of Tiger Woods. What can we say about Tiger Woods? He revolutionized the game and spoiled us with his mind on the course, dominating at a time when he spent a record for the most consecutive weeks, 281 at number one in the world, and most total weeks, 683 in that position. He has won 14 major championships. And for time, look, as he would catch Jack Nicklaus and his 79 wins, and he looked like he would surpass Sam Snead for 82 for most all the time. He even invoked the creation of what was known as tiger proofing of golf courses. But after his confessional press conference and recent reports where he has expressed he's unsure when he will or even if he can make a return to golf, we might start assuming safely that Tiger's era is officially over. As hard as it is for me to say as a longtime Tiger Woods fan, I have to say it's time for everyone, fans, media, sponsors, to fully embrace the new vanguards of the game. So no big deal. With Rory McIlroy, 26 years old, Jordan Spieth, 22, Jason Day, 27, golf is definitely in very capable hands. Even more so when you throw in Ricky Fowler, who's 26, into this mix. There have been only a handful of periods during golf's modern era since the PGA Championship became a pro stroke play in 1958, when at least three players under the age of 28 have held major titles. This new big three already have seven among them, and it's only a matter of time before Ricky Fowler joins them in that exclusive club. None of these guys is likely to surpass Woods' legacy. I mean, he was a transformational figure, a once-in-a-generation athlete whose drawing power extended beyond the golf course. Many of the folks who cheered him in didn't know or really care about the game itself. They were simply enamored, and rightly so, with someone who played it better than anyone ever had. And being an African-American in a predominantly white sport only heightened his influence. When he was in the field, the crowds ballooned and the TV ratings skyrocketed. McIlroy, Spieth, and Day won't have that sort of impact, but golf should consider itself very fortunate with them. The game couldn't have hoped for much better when it came to filling the post-Tiger void, producing three players who cover all of golf's major power bases, Europe, the United States, and Australia. The golf's top three players, Spieth, like I said, is only 22, Day 27, and McIlroy 26. Add in Ricky Fowler, who is ranked number 6, and is 26. Already, there are comparisons of the big three to another big three, maybe the greatest of them all, Nicklaus, Palmer, and Gary Player, who dominated the game in the early 1960s and wound up with a total of 34 major championships. to me, I wouldn't get too much too far ahead of ourselves with this one, the big three, because with much deeper fields and a broadening talent pool around the world, especially these 20-somes that are right now, no threesomes is likely to approach these numbers. But young guns as a whole are moving golf in the right direction, and that is forward. This year and over the last 2 years, roughly 50% of all the tournaments in the last 2 years have been won by players in their 20s, and 6 of 8 majors of the last 8 majors. Also, the TV ratings were up this year 20% from last year. Players like Patrick Reed and Brooks Koepka, who both are 25, Hideki Matsuyama, 23, near behind the big four, they lead a waterfall of talent that is injecting the PGA Tour with new life of competitiveness for the foreseeable future. Add the names of other young winners recently in that time, like reigning Rookie of the Year, Daniel Berger, 22, his runner-up, Justin Thomas, 22, Emiliano Grillo, 23, Danny Lee, 25, Smiley Kaufman, 24. And if you add to that the two that were for the Rookie of the Year on the European Tour, Benny Ann and Matthew Fitzpatrick, 21 and 24, I mean, 20-somethings are dominating golf. Fred, years from now, fans and media alike may be talking about how the 2014-2015 PGA season was the moment when the old guard blew aside and a new generation of brilliant 20-something players took over the game. They're not Tiger, but that's okay. Golf is doing just fine without him.
Yeah, Carlos, I think you've hit it right on the head. 2015 is going to go down in history as the passing of the torch from the Woods Mickelson era to the Jordan Spieth, Rory McIlroy, and Jason Day, and possibly Ricky Fowler era. These young players just they play with such aggressive demeanor, and you know, besides that, they're pretty good people. As you say, golf is in very good hands, and could this really to classify as really an era or a strong group like Hogan, Nelson, Snead, or Nicklaus Palmer player, you have to go through a 5, 6, 8 year period of one of these three winning the Masters, the U.S. Open on a consistent basis. And, we could see that. We could see the Masters for the next 5 years being won by one of these four young guys. Bubba may slip in there once in a while because that place seems to like him pretty well, or he seems to like it. But these guys are, they're the real deal. So, hey, Carlos, we talk a lot about professional golf, and we try here on the Back Nine Report, I try in the NWO Golf Links to say that, golf is for everyone and embrace the amateurs of the world. There's 20 million hackers that spend millions of dollars every year to keep the golf industry going. Somebody's got to watch TV, watch these guys on TV so they can play for these $1 million. In a report from last year, Forbes magazine cited some statistics about the size of the golf industry. Total economic impact in the U.S. is nearly $70 billion. That's with a B, not an M, $70 billion. Its charitable impact is close to $4 billion per year. That's with 143,000 events with 12 million participants. The PGA Tour boasts that it has generated nearly $2 billion in its history for a charity. Golfers as a whole generate $4 billion annually. The golf industry employs nearly 2 million Americans and pays $55.6 billion in annual wage income. Economically, golf makes a tremendous impact on the economy of the country. It is fun to watch the exploits of the best players in the world on the PGA, LPGA, Champions, European, and other professional tours around the world, but it is the mainstream average hacker that makes it possible for the big names to collect those million-dollar checks every week. Golf is the only sport where everyday people can play on the same field with the same implements as the professionals. The guys we see performing at such high levels every week on television. How cool is it to watch a golf tournament on your big screen that you've already played and can directly relate to the player's shots as you watch them. You can even play alongside the pros in pro-ams and charity events. It's pretty tough to catch a football thrown by Aaron Rodgers or play catch with Derek Jeter, but you can play golf with him. Golf is a game for a lifetime. Many athletes don't want anything to do with golf until they're forced to hang up their bat, their skates, skis, shoulder pads, and Jordan Airs, but they can continue to stroke those competitive fires with competition on the golf course, whether just with friends or in organized events. The average golfer buys the new 460cc, hit it farther and higher weapons of mass destruction, millions of golf balls, golf clubs, shoes, tees, and green fees every day. That is the lifeblood of the golf industry. We try very hard to include stories about the everyday golfer. We understand the importance of every man, woman, junior, and 30 handicapper out there that just loves to walk down a freshly mown fairway and roll his ball on a pristine green. We like to watch the pros do their thing, but the amateur, the everyday hacker, he's the most important sector of golf, Carlos.
Sorry about that. I had another technical difficulty.
You got to turn the mute button back on, Carlos.
Got it quick. I started talking, and then why am I not being heard? What happened? But no, definitely the amateurs. I mean, without them, what would be golf right now? I mean, you wouldn't have fans. You wouldn't have people that are following those pros and trying to buy all the things that they're marketing. So without them, I mean, where would golf be? I think they're both important, pros and amateurs, but amateurs is a big, huge part of golf. Hey, Fred, let's go now to our final thoughts, and I'm going to start right away with Jordan Spieth's Masters dinner. You know, the prestigious Masters Champions dinner, there have been some classy meals befitting the occasion. Tiger Woods put steak and sushi on the menu after winning 2001-2002. Phil Mickelson served seafood paella. And Machado topped left filet mignon after his 2011 win. So what does proud Texan Jordan Spieth want for his dinner next year? Texas barbecue, of course. I mean, according to a Golf News Net citing Reuters, Spieth will make the request to Augusta when the traditional dinner happens on the Tuesday evening of the Masters week. After winning in 2013, Adam Scott represented Australia with a menu including Wagyu steak, Moreton Bay bugs, and strawberry and passion fruit pavlova. That one I like. Knowing how much Texas, now that I live here, loves their barbecue, though, Spieth's menu might be even tastier. For my part, Fred, I would serve a pure assortment of Puerto Rican food, you know, rice and beans, pork chops, pasteles, mofongo, fried pork meat, and I will stop right there and go to the next news because otherwise I will have to start eating right now. I got hungry just talking. So my final piece of news is the European Tour Rookie of the Year. And finally, you know, PGA Tour players, they had a tough choice between Daniel Berger and Justin Thomas when it came time to pick this season's Rookie of the Year. However, that was nothing compared to the decision faced by those voting for the European Tour's version. Once again, it was a virtual toss-up. Only this time, they're rating both three rookies, all of whom had more impressive credentials on their respective tour than those produced by the winner Berger or runner-up Thomas. Bai Young and Benny Ann wound up winning the Sir Henry Cotton Rookie of the Year award, which is determined by three votes, one from the European Tour CEO, one from the RNA CEO, and one from the media, to become the first Asian to do so and end a two-year run of American winners, Brooks Koepka and Peter Uihlein. And any of those three had incredible years. They both won, they're all three won. Any of them would have been deserving on my mind. So, Fred, congratulations to Benny on his achievement. And can't wait to see his development alongside Matthew Fitzpatrick and Anirban Lahiri, who were the other two for the Rookie of the Year there on the European Tour.
Yeah, three pretty good names coming up there. Hey, Carlos, before I get into my final putts, I got a quote of the week that comes from Jordan Spieth. You talked about Jordan as being one of the great young players that's taking over golf, of course. you know, I think we can both agree that he's had a pretty good 2 years on tour. You know, if he believes something is worth spending time on the, you know, the range and on the practice area, the rest of us may want to listen. Spieth said in the Bahamas last week, quote, "I have to keep improving if I want to get to the level I want to reach, but I'm not there yet, not even close. I am working really hard on my putting. No one has ever done that perfectly, but what I do know is how you putt on every hole determines how happy or unhappy you are walking to the next tee, so it's worth working on." As a golf instructor, I tell students to spend as much or more time chipping and putting as they do hitting just their driver. You know, the driver works for Bubba, but Jordan Spieth won two majors this year by having a superior short game. Carlos, in my final putts, Tim Fincham announced the tour's new rule of requiring players to play in an event at least once every 4 years. The PGA Tour will require players to visit at least one tournament they have not played in the past 4 years, starting with the 2016-2017 season. PGA Tour Commissioner Tim Fincham confirmed the new policy Wednesday at the Hero World Challenge. The new rule will apply to those who play less than 25 tournaments per season. I find it curious that they announced this just as Tiger Woods is stepping away from the game. The RNA added two new female members, Judy Bell and Marlene Stewart Strait, this week. Judy Bell was the only former USGA president in modern times that was not granted a membership to the RNA because of its former stance against female members. Marlene Stewart Strait from Alberta, Canada, is the most successful Canadian female amateur golfer and the only golfer in history to have won the Australian, British, Canadian, and U.S. women's amateurs. Two of its first female members from the 2014 class, Louise Suggs and Patsy Hankins, have since passed in the last year. News from the Concessions Cup. Both teams are now set for the second Concession Cup to be held in April at the Concession Club outside of Tampa, Florida. GB and I announced their team this week. The U.S. had announced their team last month. We got some sad news in our final story tonight. Gary Hanchera, 64, who was caddying in the Champions Tour qualifying tournament for Gene Jones, collapsed in the fairway at the 15th hole at TPC Scottsdale in Arizona. Mike Goodes began CPR efforts before attempts could be made with a defibrillator and before EMTs arrived on the scene, but Hanchera was pronounced dead at the hospital approximately an hour later. Condolences to his family and friends. And Carlos, we want to one more time remind our listeners to register for the Gulf Shores Winter Golf Getaway. 3 days, two nights in a beachfront condo for your favorite foursome, three 18-hole rounds of golf. You know, plus, Gulf Shores has some of the best seafood in the world down there. So visit letsgolftravel.com, click on the register for the newsletter, and sign up for that. And also watch Facebook. We will be posting it there periodically and on Twitter. And, Carlos, that is what I have for December the 8th, 2015. Oh, don't forget, listeners, don't forget to listen next week. We've got Mike May, we've got Kieran Clark, we got Carlos and myself. We're going to have a round robin. We're going to talk about the top 10 or 12 stories in golf from 2015. Should be a really big show.
And with that, Backliners, that will wrap up another week of the Backliners Report presented by eDraft.com. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Thank you for listening to us for the past hour. Special thanks to our very important guest, VIG of the Week, Tom Deary. So don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Like Fred said, our year-ending show. You don't want to miss it. Kieran Clark, Mike May there, along with Fred and me. So don't forget, here on Blog Talk Radio, and also to tune in or download our show on iTunes. If you haven't done so, follow the show on Twitter. Our ID is at Back9Report with the number 9 in the middle. My name is Carlos Torres. I'm with Fred Alvader. We wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.